December 31st, 2002. Vancouver, British Columbia. The Vancouver Police Department received an anonymous letter containing a remorseful confession from someone who claims to have been responsible for the death of a sex worker. While the victim's name is not mentioned, investigators eventually suspect that she might be 24-year-old Danielle LaRue, who seemed to vanish without explanation 1 month before the letter arrived. While the police ask the letter writer to come forward, they are not heard from again, and no trace of Danielle is ever found. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and this week, we're going to be traveling back to our podcast's home country of Canada to explore an unsolved missing persons case involving an Indigenous woman, the 2002 disappearance of Danielle LaRue. This case was suggested to me sometime last year by a listener named Kit, and I was already familiar with Danielle's story because I had featured it in an article I published for listfirst.com over 7 years ago, titled, 10 Bizarre Anonymous Tips That Shook Up Unsolved Crimes. And this is a missing persons case where no one was even aware that the victim had disappeared until the police received an anonymous letter about her supposed death. I've released multiple podcast episodes about the topic of missing and murdered Indigenous women, as Canada has always had major issues with the epidemic of violence towards these victims and the lack of attention they often receive from law enforcement and the media. Danielle LaRue was a member of the Shuswap First Nation, who lived an incredibly difficult life fraught with abuse and addiction, and spent the good chunk of her teen and adult years as a sex worker in Vancouver's downtown Eastside neighborhood. She may have been completely forgotten to history had the Vancouver Police Department not received an anonymous letter from someone confessing their involvement in the death of a sex worker who matched Danielle's description. Even though the letter writer seemed to be remorseful for their actions, they never did come forward or provide the police with the location of the victim's remains. In fact, it's never been conclusively established if the victim was Danielle LaRue or the letter was not a hoax, but she has not been seen for 2 decades. Well, in this episode, we're going to try and figure out what happened to Danielle, as well as explore her incredibly tragic backstory and the systemic issues which lead to victims like her being trapped in such a dangerous lifestyle. 7 years ago, Danielle's case was featured on an episode of Taken, a Canadian true crime TV series which focuses on missing and murdered Indigenous women. It was featured alongside the story of Ashley McKiskinick, another First Nations woman from Vancouver's downtown Eastside, who died after falling out of a fifth-floor window at the notorious Regent Hotel in September of 2010. But even though Ashley's death was initially ruled to be a suicide, there are a number of people who believe that she was the victim of foul play. So once I'm done analyzing Danielle's case, I'll start talking about Ashley's story, as well as take a few moments to talk about the suspicious death of Verna Simard, yet another Indigenous woman who suffered a fatal fall from a window at the Regent Hotel exactly 1 year and 1 day after Ashley did. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, including stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now start off by exploring the disappearance of Danielle LaRue. Our story begins in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada in 2002. On New Year's Eve, an anonymous typewritten letter was dropped off at the public service counter of the Vancouver Police Department. Now, the full contents of this letter have never been released publicly, as law enforcement has redacted certain sections, but here's how the letter started off. Quote, "To police. I sent message about this to Vancouver police a few days after incident, but have seen nothing in news about it. Am guessing they either didn't receive it or can't match info to victim." So here is letter again with additional information. This is about Vancouver prostitute who disappear at the end of November 2002. Don't remember name she gave me, had no ID. Sounded like she had just recently come to Vancouver. Caucasian, long black curly hair, jeans, black leather jacket, tattoos, and jewelry. She is dead. End quote. The next several sentences have been redacted, but here are the last few sentences of this lengthy paragraph. Quote, "I send this info so you can notify your family. If you can, please make mention of her in Vancouver Sun. I would like to know who she was." End quote. Law enforcement has withheld the entire next paragraph of the letter from the public, but here's how it concluded. Quote, "To her family, I am more sorry than you can imagine. I did not intend this, but am still responsible. She will not be unmourned. Have brought flowers to her grave once already, plan to do so every year as am able. Not ideal, but better than no visits at all. I know you can't forgive me, but please believe, I tried my very hardest to bring her back." End quote. Anyway, sometime over the next few months, the Vancouver PD attempted to figure out who the unnamed female victim in the letter might be. On May the 12th, 2003, during the police's daily briefing with the press, they announced that they were issuing an alert for a 24-year-old missing woman named Danielle Marissa LaRue and stated that it would be, quote-unquote, "of considerable value to the investigators and of great comfort to Danielle's family if the person who reported her missing could contact them." However, the details about Danielle's disappearance were so vague that none of the newspapers in Metro Vancouver reported on it. It was not until May the 20th when journalist Daphne Bramham published an article in the Vancouver Sun titled "What's Missing Here is Justice," which revealed that Danielle LaRue was a sex worker from Vancouver's downtown Eastside neighborhood with a known history of drug issues, and she had not been seen since the previous December. Bramham was very critical of the fact that the Vancouver PD waited 5 months to announce that Danielle was missing, and at this point, they had not yet publicly mentioned the mysterious anonymous letter they had received. Over the next 4 years, Danielle's disappearance would receive scant coverage in the media, as the police only revealed that they had received information that she was missing and asked anyone with knowledge of her whereabouts to come forward. It was not until March of 2007 when John Daly, a reporter with Global TV News, took a fresh look at Danielle's case and learned about the anonymous letter. Shortly thereafter, the Vancouver PD finally told the public about the letter and partially shared its contents. They now confirmed that they believed the woman the writer had confessed to killing was Danielle, as the last time she was known to be alive was sometime in late November of 2002. In March of 2008, Daphne Bramham published an extensive article about Danielle's backstory in the Vancouver Sun titled, "Danielle LaRue Never Had Chance to Succeed." Danielle was originally born in Kamloops, and her father, Norman LaRue, was a member of the Neskonlith, which is part of the Shuswap First Nation. Norman fathered a total of 6 children with 3 different women, and the mother of Danielle and her 2 siblings was Caucasian. Danielle had a younger sister named Kim and a younger brother named Norman Jr., and since both their parents were alcoholics, they all experienced traumatic childhoods filled with physical and sexual abuse. The 3 siblings were all taken away from their parents and placed in foster care, but at age 10, Danielle actually took the initiative to kidnap Kim and Norman Jr. from one of their abusive foster homes and managed to keep them hidden for a while before they were found by the police. When she was a child, Danielle had been given the nickname Holy Smoke, since she was described as being a fearless spitfire who was very protective of her younger siblings and always took care of them. In fact, when Kim was interviewed for the aforementioned Vancouver Sun article, she credited Danielle as being the only reason she was still alive by that point. By the time she was 13, Danielle had run away from foster care and was living in Prince George, where she turned to sex work and developed a heroin habit. I'll go into more detail later on about the troubled backstory of Danielle's father, Norman Sr., but on February the 24th, 1989, he was charged with second-degree murder after fatally attacking his 35-year-old friend Larry Maristi with a baseball bat and fracturing his skull 5 times. Norman lived in a one-room shack next to a rooming house in Kamloops, and prior to Larry's death, the two men had been on a 2-day drinking binge, and their respective blood alcohol levels were around 3 or 4 times the legal limit. After killing Larry, Norman proceeded to drag his body outside his shack and left him lying on the sidewalk. In September of that year, Norman was convicted of the murder and received a sentence of life imprisonment with no possibility of parole for 10 years. However, Norman's conviction was overturned by the British Columbia Court of Appeal in May of 1991, and when he went back on trial for the second time 5 months later, a mistrial had to be declared after a Kamloops newspaper published a story containing too many confidential details about the murder. While Norman was scheduled to go on trial again in June of 1992, the Crown elected to stay the charges because one of the original investigators and 2 key witnesses had died and another witness left the country, so they no longer felt they had the necessary evidence to secure a conviction. After Norman was released from prison, he turned his life around for a while, but succumbed to a fatal heroin overdose in February of 2000 at the age of 59. As for Danielle's mother, she had managed to get sober and left her abusive relationship with Norman in order to become an addictions counselor until she died of cancer in 1995. Shortly thereafter, Danielle relocated to the downtown east side in Vancouver, which was considered to be the most dangerous neighborhood in the city. Kim stated, quote, "Everyone knew that once you went to the downtown east side, you were done. You were either going to be dead or in jail. Those were the only exits you had. It's like a big black pit with stabbings, murders, and ODs. It's crazy down here. Nobody cares about anybody but themselves and their next fix." End quote. Indeed, the downtown east side received a lot of undue publicity when notorious serial killer Robert Picton was arrested in February of 2002. As you may know, Picton is one of the worst serial killers in the history of Canada, who wound up being convicted of the murders of 6 women and received a sentence of life imprisonment with no possibility of parole for 25 years. However, even though he was not actually convicted of all of them, Picton was originally charged with the murders of 26 women and is claimed to have killed at least 49. A number of Picton's victims were sex workers from the downtown east side, and one of the reasons he managed to get away with it for so long is because the police never bothered to investigate their disappearances. Now, obviously, since Picton was arrested several months before Danielle LaRue went missing, he has been ruled out as having any involvement in her case, but it became apparent that Danielle was yet another vulnerable victim from the downtown east side whose disappearance managed to slip under the radar for a lengthy period of time. Other than the anonymous letter, the Vancouver PD did not have any strong leads in Danielle's case, only that she just seemed to vanish without explanation sometime in late 2002. In 2014, the police launched a new website for their unsolved cold cases at vpcoldcases.ca and put together a profile page for Danielle, which featured an overview of her case as well as a photograph of a heavily redacted version of the letter. Danielle's story would receive national coverage in September of 2016 when it was featured on an episode of Taken, a Canadian true crime series which focuses on unsolved cold cases involving missing and murdered Indigenous women. The last major media coverage of Danielle's case occurred in December of 2018 when she was featured on the Cold Case BC podcast, which is hosted by Monica Gould, a reporter for City News 1130. The podcast featured an interview with Danielle's half-brother, Jules LaRue, Norman LaRue's son from another relationship, who has been heavily involved with the inquiry into missing and murdered Indigenous women. Jules said that without any corroborating evidence, he believed that the anonymous letter about Danielle's death was nothing more than hearsay, so he held out the faint hope that she might still be alive somewhere. The podcast also contained comments from Sergeant Jason Robillard, the case's new lead investigator for the Vancouver PD, who made another public plea towards the letter's anonymous writer, stating, quote, "You know what happened to Danielle, where her body is buried, and you seem to be remorseful. It's time to do the right thing and finally bring answers and closure for Danielle's family. It's been 16 years, and it's time to clear your conscience and come forward." End quote. But this is yet to take place, and after 2 decades, Danielle LaRue continues to remain a missing person. So I guess you could say, The Trail Went Cold. So I featured a lot of victims on The Trail Went Cold, but I don't think too many of them had a sadder or more tragic backstory than Danielle LaRue. She had one of the most traumatic childhoods you can imagine, and the Vancouver Sun headline about her backstory, "Danielle LaRue Never Had a Chance to Succeed," described her situation perfectly. While both of Danielle's parents were very troubled individuals, the Taken episode about her case featured interviews with her maternal grandparents, Robert and Evelyn Dick, who both come across like decent people who genuinely cared about her. However, it was incredibly sad to hear them say that they just did not have many memories of Danielle being happy during her childhood. I mentioned earlier that Danielle's mother was Caucasian and struggled with alcoholism, and while she did get sober and make an attempt to turn her life around, she wound up succumbing to cancer at a fairly young age. However, it sounds like Danielle's father, Norman LaRue, had just as traumatic a childhood as she did, and while this doesn't excuse the abuse he inflicted on his own family, it does provide some context into the generational trauma many Indigenous people are forced to experience. Norman's mother was murdered when he was still an infant, and since his father was an alcoholic World War II veteran who was unfit to take care of him, Norman would be raised by his grandparents. But he was eventually placed in a residential school in Kamloops, and if you heard the episode I released 3 years ago about the disappearance of Tamara Keepness, you'll know what horrible places those schools were for Indigenous children. Long story short, residential schools were a network of government-sponsored religious boarding schools where Indigenous children would be sent so they could be assimilated into Christian culture and eliminate all aspects of their own culture. Students at these schools were often subject to horrific acts of physical, emotional, and sexual abuse, and it's estimated that somewhere between 3,000 to 6,000 children died within their walls. As a result, many of these students would go on to develop post-traumatic stress disorder and substance abuse issues, and this is why they are often referred to as survivors. It's clear that Norman was subject to a lot of systemic abuse during his time there, and during the late stages of his life, he became one of the very first people to sign on to a class action lawsuit filed against the government over these schools. If Norman's childhood wasn't tragic enough, he reunited with his abusive father when he was 12 years old, and they wound up spending an entire summer binge drinking together, which undoubtedly played a huge role in him developing substance abuse issues. Norman was a very violent and dangerous person when he was drunk, as he was physically abusive towards his family and even spent time in prison for murder at one point, but the ironic thing is that he was apparently a very charming and intelligent person who managed to accomplish a number of things when he was sober. He started a free medical clinic for Skid Row residents in Kamloops, was heavily involved in civil rights activism, and even worked as a freelance broadcaster for CBC Radio at one point. After his murder conviction was overturned and he was released from prison, Norman made some money carving totem poles and selling his artwork to the Kamloops Art Gallery, though his demons ultimately got the better of him since he died of a fatal heroin overdose. I haven't spoken much about the backstory of his son and Danielle's brother, Norman LaRue Jr., but his life has been an absolute disaster. Norman Jr. was sexually abused by female relatives when he was a child, and he went on to become an alcoholic who started committing crimes in his teens, and at the age of 18, he was charged and convicted of aggravated sexual assault after slashing the throat of a woman who refused to have sex with him. He wound up being declared a long-term offender, and after being released from prison on parole, Norman Jr. and his girlfriend, Christina Asp, skipped town and traveled to Whitehorse, Yukon, and on March 26, 2008, they teamed up to beat a 63-year-old resident named Gordon Siebel to death with a baseball bat inside his home before setting the place on fire. After Norman Jr. was convicted of first-degree murder, he received a sentence of life imprisonment with no possibility of parole for 25 years, and he is still incarcerated today. Since all three of the LaRue siblings had a history of run-ins with the law, there was one occasion where Danielle, Kim, and Norman Jr. all wound up appearing in court on the exact same day for various offenses. After running away from foster care at the age of 13, Kim lived with Danielle and Prince George, and while she said her sister did everything she could to protect her, Kim wound up developing her own heroin habit and turned to sex work to support her addiction. She also had a total of 4 children, who would all be placed in foster care. It appeared that Kim was destined to go down the same sad path as her siblings, but her big wake-up call occurred after she was released in jail in 2006 after serving a 2-year sentence for armed robbery. Her boyfriend bought them both bus tickets out of British Columbia, and Kim said that after smoking one last pipe of crack cocaine in the bus depot parking lot, they threw the pipes away and decided to move on from drugs when they left town. When she was interviewed in the Vancouver Sun 2 years later, Kim said she was doing quite well. She was in a methadone program at that point and working her first steady job ever in hopes of eventually attending university to study law, though she admitted, quote, "From the age you start taking drugs, you stop growing. Socially, I'm like a 13-year-old," end quote. Well, from what I've seen about her online, Kim has managed to completely turn her life around and pretty much credits this to her sister, because if Danielle had not been around to watch her back, Kim may have wound up dead a long time ago. So even though Danielle lived an incredibly tragic life, the fact that Kim is still around and enjoying success is Danielle's legacy, which is why her surviving loved ones desperately want answers about what happened to her. Kim has said that at this point, she doesn't even really care if the person responsible for Danielle's death is prosecuted for their actions, as the family's top priority is finding out the truth about what happened to her and hopefully recovering her remains and giving her a proper burial. Her half-brother Jules has stated that he still holds out hope that Danielle ran off and started over and is still alive out there somewhere, but even if the confession letter is a hoax, or the writer was referring to another woman besides Danielle, there have not been any confirmed sightings of her in over 2 decades. Even if she was not murdered by the individual who wrote the letter, it's also possible that Danielle could have died by other means, such as a drug overdose, and is a nameless Jane Doe somewhere waiting to be identified. But it must be reiterated that even though it's assumed that the victim mentioned in the letter was Danielle, we still can't know this with 100% certainty. The ironic thing is that regardless of the letter's veracity, it is pretty much the only reason the general public even knows Danielle's story to begin with. I find it incredibly sad that the majority of photos you'll find for Danielle online are from when she was a child, and the only existing photo of Danielle as an adult appears to be a mugshot. One of the obstacles of trying to figure out the exact circumstances of how and when Danielle went missing is that I'm not entirely sure she had a place to go missing from. We know that she was last confirmed to be alive in around late November of 2002, but was she residing anywhere at the time, or was she living on the streets? Even though the letter was dropped off at the Vancouver police station on New Year's Eve in 2002, the police did not make any public announcement about Danielle's disappearance until May of 2003. I know that the Vancouver PD received some criticism for waiting 5 months to do so, particularly with all the negative publicity surrounding their handling of the Robert Picton case. Picton managed to get away with his crimes for so long because so many of his victims were sex workers who slipped through the cracks and did not receive any sort of police investigation when they went missing. When Daphne Bramham published her scathing column about this in the Vancouver Sun, she mentioned that over 60 women, including Danielle, had gone missing from the downtown east side over the past 2 decades. But to be fair to the Vancouver PD, the letter did not mention the victim's name, and since it's unclear when Danielle was noticed to be missing, I can see how investigators might have taken 5 months to put 2 and 2 together. However, what I don't understand is why they elected not to publicize the letter until March of 2007. I certainly don't disagree with their decision to release a redacted version of the letter and withhold key details, but why not mention it at all for 4 years? Even if the writer didn't want to come forward, you just never know if seeing the letter might ring a bell for someone out there and compel them to share an important tip. Anyway, since the letter is the only real evidence we have to work with in this case, let's analyze the contents which have been released publicly. Curiously, the writer starts off by stating that they had originally sent a message to the police only a few days after the victim died in late November of 2002, but since they didn't see anything in the news about it, they figured they would send this second letter. I have never seen police confirm if they received another letter prior to the New Year's Eve one, but perhaps it was just ignored or lost in the shuffle. But what's unusual is that there was nothing in the news about Danielle's disappearance until May of 2003. Given that only 1 month had passed since the writers supposedly sent their first letter, did they make any further attempts to contact the police during the next 5 month window? And let's not forget that even though Danielle's disappearance made the news, the letter was not mentioned for another 4 years. So did the writer figure out that she was the woman he was referring to? Now, there are some details about the victim in the letter which don't match Danielle, such as the writer saying she was Caucasian. Well, Danielle was mixed race, as she had an indigenous father and a Caucasian mother, but if you look at her mugshot, I guess you could see how a stranger might mistakenly assume she was Caucasian. The writer also said that it sounded like the victim had just recently come to Vancouver, which was not the case with Danielle, since she had been living in the downtown east side for about 5 or 6 years at that point. But theoretically, if the writer was a customer who had been soliciting Danielle for sex work, then I could see her not telling the full truth about her backstory. The letter contained the line, quote, "Don't remember name she gave me," and since Danielle was apparently known for using a number of different aliases, who knows if the name she even provided to the writer was real. Right before the first redacted section of the letter, the writer mentions that the woman had tattoos. The police would later release details about distinctive tattoos that Danielle had, including a heart and word on her left forearm, a cross on her right arm, a heart on the back of her torso, and black hearts on her chest. This makes me wonder if the writer mentioned specific details about the victim's tattoos in the redacted sections that matched Danielle, which is why investigators became certain it was her. So between the sections of the letter in which the writer describes the victim and then expresses remorse for what happened, there is an entire paragraph which has been redacted, and I have to assume this might be when they shared more specific details about how the victim died. Some of the lines near the end, such as, quote, "I did not intend this, but I'm still responsible," and, quote, "I tried my very hardest to bring her back," give off the impression that the woman's death may have been an accidental drug overdose or something, and the writer panicked and disposed of her body. However, I find it interesting that most of the press releases about Danielle use sentences like, quote, "The Vancouver Police Department believes she was murdered," and at no point have investigators attempted to imply that she was the victim of an accidental death. This is why I think there might be some information within that redacted paragraph in which the writer admitted to inflicting violence on Danielle, and even if they didn't intend on killing her, they were still fully responsible for her death. I can definitely understand why this section would be redacted in order to weed out false tips, because if anyone came forward and made a confession and shared information from the letter which was never released publicly, then the police would know they were telling the truth. I also believe that if Danielle's death was an accidental overdose and the writer was genuinely remorseful, they could still provide the location of Danielle's body in order to bring some peace to her family. But instead, they talk about bringing flowers to her grave, even though she technically doesn't even have a grave, and may be buried in some remote spot that only the writer knows about. So this tells me that the writer is paranoid about potentially being charged with murder if Danielle's remains were ever found. The wording of the letter makes it sound like the writer was a complete stranger to the victim, but if by chance it was someone with a personal connection to Danielle, I could see them pretending not to know who she is in order to throw off the investigation. Now, even though Danielle spent the last several years of her life as a sex worker, Kim claimed that her sister never had a pimp, stating, quote, "she was way too tough for that." As far as personal relationships go, Kim said that Danielle only had one serious boyfriend when she was 16, who later beat her and took her money. But otherwise, here's how she described Danielle's other relationships with men, quote, "she kept them like pets. She'd take care of them for a while, and when she got bored, she'd get another one," end quote. For all we know, the writer of the letter could have been someone like that, but since we know nothing about Danielle's personal life at the time she went missing, and what kind of men she was interacting with, we can only just speculate. During our interview on the Taken episode, Kim expressed frustration over those redacted portions of the letter still being withheld from the public, as not even Danielle's family had been privy to the information which was written there. I mean, I'm not saying that police should release the contents of the entire letter, but it's been 2 decades since they originally received it, and there haven't been any new developments in the case in quite some time. So could there be any harm in sharing a bit more information which might help bring in some new leads? What if some of the redacted details contain anything which might ring a bell with someone and help them figure out who the writer is? For all we know, after all this time, the writer may no longer be alive, which would make the case all the more difficult to solve. I certainly can't rule out the possibility that the letter is a hoax, but let's not forget that this isn't someone attempting to confess to the death of a missing or murdered victim who had a lot of publicity in the media. This is a letter confessing to the death of a nameless victim, and if she was Danielle LaRue, no one even knew she was missing at that point. And if the letter was nothing more than an attempt to garner attention, the writer didn't really succeed at their goal, since the letter was not publicized for another 4 years. I do get the sense that the writer did harm someone and developed a conscience over it, and while it's never conclusively proven that the victim was Danielle, there are numerous factors which would make you conclude that it was most likely her. At the end of the letter, the writer said, quote, "I know you can't forgive me," and when interviewed on the BC Cold Case podcast, Jules was asked if he could forgive the person who was responsible for Danielle's death. But his response was no, because even if the letter writer was feeling remorseful about what they did, they have still not taken full responsibility or led Danielle's loved ones to her remains, so the letter has left them in a state of limbo. If by chance the letter is a hoax and nothing more than a red herring, then the silver lining is that it has brought attention to a story which may have otherwise not received any attention. Danielle LaRue lived a very tragic life, but she should not be forgotten, and I hope her case will have a conclusive resolution someday. So now let's start talking about the other case which was featured on the Taken episode alongside Danielle's story, and that's the unexplained death of 22-year-old Ashley McKiskinick. Ashley was a member of the Kewakatoos First Nation and hailed from the Kewakatoos Reserve in southeast Saskatchewan. Much like Danielle LaRue, Ashley spent her childhood in and out of foster homes before her mother brought her to Vancouver at age 12. Throughout her teen years, Ashley was in the care of the British Columbia Ministry of Children and Family Development, which is responsible for child protection services across the province, but when she turned 19 and became a legal adult, the ministry was forced to cut her loose. Ashley was diagnosed with chronic schizophrenia and had to be hospitalized several times for psychosis, depression, and mania. After spending 10 consecutive months in a mental health facility, Ashley was transferred to Vancouver's St. Paul's Hospital, where she was reluctant to receive treatment and stopped taking her medications shortly before she was released in March of 2010. 6 months later, Ashley was residing at the Regent Hotel on East Hastings Street in the downtown East Side. But on September the 15th, Ashley suddenly fell to her death after flying out the window of room 518 of the hotel and landing in an alley below. The Vancouver PD would investigate Ashley's death, and after performing a search of room 518, they found no blood or any apparent signs of struggle to suggest foul play. Ashley's autopsy would reveal that she had high levels of alcohol and cocaine in her system, and aside from the injury sustained from the fall, she did not appear to have any additional injuries to indicate that she had gotten into an altercation prior to her death. Even though there was speculation that Ashley might have been murdered, Vancouver police spokesman, Constable Lindsay Houghton, told the media that this was nothing more than, quote-unquote, a tragic rumor that has not been corroborated, a case of what appears, after investigation, to be someone taking their own life. Well, this statement raised the ire of Ashley's friends and relatives, who did not believe her death was a suicide. One major issue was that Ashley had been found lying on her back approximately 12 feet across the alley from the window, so her loved ones were skeptical that she could have jumped that distance on her own and landed in that position. One outspoken advocate for Ashley was an activist named Angelie Marie McDougall, executive director of the Battered Women's Support Services Association, who claimed that she knew of at least 6 women who had been thrown out of windows as punishment by drug dealers, which was a common practice in the downtown East Side. These dealers would apparently use sex workers as drug mules, but if they had addiction issues and did not pay their own drug debts, they would be punished in very public ways. It was rumored that if a woman's drug debt was $30, they would be sexually assaulted or beaten or humiliated by having their head shaved, but if the debt was as high as $50, they would be killed. It was theorized that Ashley may have been thrown through a fifth-floor window into the alley because it was a common spot for people to buy drugs, and this sent a message about what would happen to those who did not pay their own drug debts. The dealers were able to get away with this practice because witnesses were unwilling to come forward and incriminate them, so the police often wrote these women's deaths off as suicides or drug overdoses. On October the 4th, the Native Women's Association of Canada held a vigil for Ashley at the spot where she was killed and led a Sisters in Spirit march to the Vancouver PD's Main Street headquarters in order to hold a protest in which three people, including Angela Marie McDougall, were arrested. In response, the police issued a statement that Constable Houghton's remarks about Ashley taking her own life had been a mistake and that the case was never officially closed. A few weeks later, Police Chief Jim Chu announced that they were launching a new committee called the Guardian Project, which was designed to eliminate violence against women and girls from the downtown east side. This would involve launching an anonymous tip line staffed by female civilians who could assist victims calling them for help, and the Guardian Project would later be rebranded as Sister Watch. Another individual who advocated for Ashley and did not believe her death was a suicide was Dave Dixon, a retired Vancouver police officer who had since become an outreach worker and first came across Ashley on the street when she was 15 years old. Dixon claimed that two women told him that they had been in room 518 with Ashley and some men, but since they were frightened of these men, they left the room a short time before Ashley's fatal fall. Dixon also spoke to a witness who said that they saw an unknown individual toss Ashley's shoes out the hotel room window a few seconds after she already landed in the alley. However, none of the witnesses were willing to go on the record and share this information with police for fear of their own lives, so Ashley's death was never reclassified as a homicide. After performing a new investigation, Coroner Lindsey Graham concluded, quote, "As there has been no evidence located to satisfy the questions as to how she came to fall to her death, I classify this death as undetermined and make no recommendations." End quote. Well, believe it or not, on September the 16th, 2011, exactly 1 year and 1 day after Ashley's death, another Indigenous woman would suffer a fatal fall out of a sixth-floor window at the Regent Hotel. The victim in question was 50-year-old Verna Samard, who originally hailed from Red Lake, Ontario, and was a member of the Wabagoon First Nation. Like the other victims we profiled, Verna had a very traumatic childhood, as she lost her mother at a young age and was taken from her father to be placed in a children's aid society where she was abused. She had a total of 5 children throughout the course of her life and lost one of her sons, but even though she often struggled with addiction issues, her children said that she never showed them her bad side and was always a loving mother. At the time of her death, Verna had spent the past 2 years living in a single resident occupancy suite at the Regent Hotel. She worked as a bartender at another nearby hotel and was known for being a strong advocate for finding better housing for women in the downtown east side, but she was also in a long-term relationship with a man who was believed to be abusive, and her co-workers would often notice Verna showing up to work with bruises. Well, this man happened to be inside Verna's room at the time of her death, so he was taken to the police station for questioning. He maintained that Verna's death had been an accident, as he claimed that she was swinging her legs outside the window while leaning her body backwards into the room, but when she lost her grip on the window, she slipped and fell to her death. One witness would report having heard a male voice yelling, quote, "Don't do that," right before Verna fell out the window, and they soon saw a man run to the stairwell. The coroner's report also revealed that Verna had a moderate to heavy level of alcohol intoxication, which may have contributed to her fall. However, a number of other people reported hearing loud arguing from Verna's room, followed by loud screaming, and one witness even said he heard her yell out, "Help me." However, all these various eyewitness statements supposedly contained a number of inconsistencies and seemed to contradict each other, as some residents said they heard no arguing or screaming at all. In the end, the coroner ruled that Verna's cause of death could only be listed as undetermined, and no charges were ever filed. The Vancouver PD announced that they were closing the investigation, but said that they would reopen it if new evidence ever surfaced. Now, this is a completely unrelated case, but I thought it was worth mentioning that there's another similar and controversial death which took place in Regina, Saskatchewan, involving a 29-year-old Indigenous woman named Nadine McKiskinick, who is of no relation to Ashley McKiskinick. I'm not going to go into too many details about this one, since I may cover it on a separate podcast episode, but on January the 20th, 2015, Nadine was killed after falling 10 stories down a laundry chute at the Delta Hotel, but even though the Regina Police Department ruled her death to be an accident and closed the case, her family believed that the investigation was botched and that Nadine was the victim of foul play. So Canada just seems to have an abnormally high number of Indigenous women who die under suspicious circumstances after suffering a fall at a hotel. Getting back to Ashley McKiskinick's case, a $10,000 reward was initially offered for information, but the reward expired during the fall of 2012, and after performing what they considered to be an exhaustive investigation, the Vancouver PD stated that they deemed Ashley's death not to be suspicious. And it really doesn't appear that the formation of Sister Watch has done much to bring a resolution to many of these cold cases, as Angela Marie McDougall eventually became disillusioned with the committee and left them, stating, quote, "The committee was designed to hold the police accountable for the lackadaisical and gross failures in responding to violence against some in the neighborhood. Sister Watch has not followed through on any of what they committed to. Police are not fanning out missing persons posters throughout community organizations, nor were they conducting proper investigations into missing persons in the downtown east side." End quote. If there's a bright side, the Regent Hotel, a truly decrepit and dangerous place, was officially declared to be unsafe by the city in June of 2018. It had more than 1,000 bylaw violations by that point, so the hotel finally shut down, and its residents were moved into a nearby property purchased by the British Columbia government. The region is currently owned by the City of Vancouver and undergoing maintenance and renovations, but the costs have exceeded over $1 million and the building is still vacant. The hotel was pretty much considered to be a last resort for people to live if they had no other place to go, and it's incredibly troubling just how many women died under suspicious circumstances after falling out of windows there. It would not surprise me if Danielle LaRue went to the region at some point, but her sister Kim was pretty much on the money when she said that most women who wind up in the downtown east side never leave there alive. At the very least, Danielle LaRue, Ashley McKiskinick, and Verna Simard have advocates who care about finding the truth about what happened to them, but it's disturbing to think how many Indigenous women we don't even know about who have suffered similar fates. Now, officially, Ashley and Verna's deaths are both considered to be undetermined, largely because the authorities lack the necessary evidence to reclassify their deaths as a homicide. In Verna's case, we know that her boyfriend was in the room at the time she fell to her death, though he told police it was accidental because she was dangling her legs out the window and lost her balance. This guy's name has never been released publicly, but yeah, even if he had been known for being a loving spouse, I'd have a hard time believing his story. But it was apparently no big secret that he was abusive, and there were witnesses who reported hearing an argument inside the room prior to Verna's death, so if these witnesses are accurate, it's pretty easy to figure out what likely happened here. However, there does not appear to be any direct evidence that Verna was murdered, which is why no one has ever been charged. Unlike Ashley's case, it appears that Verna's death was the result of a domestic dispute rather than anything to do with drug dealers. But since the police mentioned inconsistencies in the various eyewitness statements, I still have to wonder if there are people who know more than they've let on. The rumor surrounding Ashley's death is that she was just one of many women from that area who were killed or seriously harmed due to a failure to pay a drug debt. In most cases, you wouldn't think that throwing a victim from a window in a public place would be the most logical way to murder someone, since there are a number of potential witnesses around. But there was apparently such a culture of fear in the downtown east side that the dealers who did this knew that no one would be willing to talk to the authorities, and killing someone in such a public fashion sends a message to others about what could happen to them if they did not pay their debts. And if these victims were poverty-stricken drug addicts, I'm sure these dealers knew that the Vancouver PD would not make it a top priority to investigate their deaths. Now, given that Ashley had numerous substance abuse and mental health issues, including chronic schizophrenia, I suppose I cannot completely rule out the possibility that she could have jumped out the window on her own, but it sounds like the logistics of how she fell might make this impossible. Granted, I haven't seen the actual crime scene photos, but those who believe Ashley was murdered state that she was found in the alley about 12 feet from the window and was lying on her back. If Ashley had gotten a running start and jumped through the window, I suppose it's possible she could have reached that distance, but unless she somehow twisted her body around in midair, she probably would have landed on her front. I can't think of too many suicides in which the victim intentionally ran backwards through a window, so the logistics seem to support Ashley being pushed or thrown by one or more individuals. We have two other women who said that there were multiple men inside Ashley's room before she fell, and an eyewitness who said that Ashley's shoes were thrown out the window separately after she already landed. If these details were true, I'd say that rules out the possibility of a suicide, but the problem is that we only know this information because it was shared secondhand by retired cop turned outreach worker Dave Dixon after these witnesses spoke to him. It does not sound like they were willing to go on the record and share this information with the police, which is why they lack the evidence to officially reclassify Ashley's death as a homicide. Even though there's nothing to indicate that the cases are connected, it seems incredible that two separate women could be thrown to their deaths from the window of the Regent Hotel almost exactly 1 year apart from each other, but this is what happens when a culture of fear is established in which being labeled a snitch is considered worse than being labeled a murderer. The consensus seems to be that as long as everyone keeps their mouth shut, the Vancouver PD will not make too much of an effort to solve the cases. But of course, even if these victims do not receive justice, it is still necessary to produce podcast episodes such as this to ensure they are not forgotten. A resolution to all the cases we've covered today seems to hinge on the right person coming forward, so if you happen to have any information about the disappearance of Danielle LaRue or the deaths of Ashley McKiskinick and Verna Simard, please contact the Vancouver Police Department's Cold Case Unit at 604-717-2500. That's 604-717-2500. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. Over the past 5 years, our Patreon page has released dozens of exclusive bonus episodes, which are all currently available in our archives for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3. This past month, I released a Halloween-themed bonus episode about the Guardian UFO case, which explores the odd 1991 sighting of a mysterious object in a field just outside my hometown of Ottawa, Ontario. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discuss another Halloween-themed mystery, the unexplained 1988 death of David Stone. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries, and we now have over 50 of these commentary tracks in our archives. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Cindy O. and Kathy M. Thank you all so much for your support. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composed the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. So have yourselves a great week and join us again next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold.